David Reamer, welcome to KABU.
Thank you, Bill. It's good to be with you.
David Reamer is a policy wonk with a big heart. He's studied U.S. social welfare and health programs. Along the way, he had actually many, if you look at his resume, many prestigious positions, including a legal counsel for Ted Kennedy's subcommittee on health and science research way back then. Recently, he, with others, they've developed a set of programs that would greatly reduce poverty in Wisconsin and, if replicated in the United States, all over the country, of course. We'll be discussing that. Also, how what look like visionary programs, but they're, in fact, extremely practical. It would be really good for the country and the people. We'll be discussing how these programs could be won. But first, David, tell us about your policy proposals.
Well, I'm glad to do that. The starting point was to try to understand why we have so much poverty. There are a lot of different ways to get at that, but our approach was fairly simple. We looked at the people who are poor and their relationship with the labor market. Most people get out of poverty by working, earning enough, and then when they retire, having enough combined with Social Security and savings to have a decent life. So we basically asked the question, are there enough jobs? Do people earn enough when they do work? And are there people who fall through the cracks of the disability system for those who can't work and the Social Security retirement system for those who've retired? And the answer to all those questions, Bill, was yes. Although there have been a few times in history where the number of people who want to work and the number of jobs that are available are roughly comparable. You think of, obviously, the Second World War, the end of the dot-com boom, things were pretty much evenly matched. But most of the time, there are significantly more people looking for jobs than there are jobs that are available in the labor market. In other words, a big part of poverty is that there just aren't enough jobs to go around. The problem is particularly visible when you go beyond the official unemployment measure and you actually look at all the people who are really unemployed who aren't counted. The unemployment measure is a very conservative measure. It requires you to have been actively looking for work for the last several weeks. So if you've given up because you've tried and couldn't get a job, or if you've got a few hours of work and you're mostly unemployed but you're just working a little bit, you're not even counted as unemployed. So the real number of unemployed has exceeded the supply of job openings by millions. Right now, there's about a 2 million gap, and that's using, again, the most conservative measure. The real number of unemployed for whom there literally would be no job if every single vacancy were filled is probably 3 or 4 million. So clearly, part of the problem is there just aren't enough jobs for people. An equal part of the problem is that a huge percentage of the jobs that people do find and fill don't pay enough. The wages are too low. And even in some cases, when you add on food stamps or the earned income tax credit or other government programs that sometimes are direct benefits, sometimes they're coming through the tax system, the disposable income that people have still leaves them below not only the official poverty line, but other measures of poverty that are often seen as more realistic. The third problem is that there clearly is in this society, like in any society, a group of people who can't work because they have a disability. They have a mental disability or a physical disability, either on a long-term or short-term basis. And we, like most societies, say we don't expect you to work. We provide disability benefits through several different programs. But there's a large group of folks who are getting disability benefits who still remain poor. In other words, the benefits are too low. And then finally, another group whom we don't expect to work, seniors who've retired age 65 or older, they have worked their whole life. They are retired workers, but the amount they get on Social Security plus their savings leave them below the poverty line.
That's a group that's going to really increase, in fact, in the next many years, as because companies are no longer funding decent pensions.
That's right. That we've moved almost entirely away from the so-called defined benefit pension programs that would guarantee you an income stream after years of work, and we moved more and more into the programs based on your savings. The problem is that a lot of people don't save, and those that do, a fair number of them lost their shirt in the Great Recession. So even if they did everything right, a lot of it was wiped out by the near collapse of the economy during that period.
This is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to David Reamer. public policy expert in many things, health and income programs and jobs. We've been talking about the reasons for poverty. David, tell us about the program that you've developed based on the understandings you gave us as to why there's poverty.
Sure.
And so much poverty in this country. There's so much money, and yet so many people are really dirt poor, and even more are enormously precarious, you know, one heartbeat away from destitution, it seems to me, for very large numbers of people.
Well, that's right. And before going into what we thought of as the solution, during the 50s and 60s, poverty was coming down. More and more people were getting work and incomes were rising. But then around 1973, the music died, so to speak, and poverty has been pretty flat ever since. And then, as some experts have pointed out, the volatility of employment and income has gotten worse. So we consulted with some local experts, some national experts. The people I work with also have a lot of experience as community organizers, labor organizers. And we came up with a 5-point plan. The first part of it was simply to bring back government-funded jobs program. So these days, this kind of program is called transitional jobs or transitional employment. So the idea was, we said, let's put in place a policy that offers the unemployed or people who have less than 40 hours of work a guarantee of full-time employment at the minimum wage until they can find a regular job in the regular economy. The second policy was to raise the minimum wage. The national minimum wage has been stuck at $7.25 an hour for years. Some states and cities, and I know in Oregon you've been doing this, have raised it. But we basically said, let's see what happens if you raised it for the whole country. A third policy that we looked at was to increase something called the Earned Income Tax Credit. Back 20 years ago, if I used those words, most people would have not had an idea what it meant. But these days, a fair number of people know what the EITC or the Earned Income Tax Credit is. Essentially, it supplements your earnings. So if your earnings are below a certain level, the EITC is either a reduction in your taxes or it actually gives you a payment through the tax system that tops up your earnings up to certain specified levels, and then it phases out. The fourth policy that we looked at was to guarantee child care for people. A fair number of people who are looking for work or working have younger kids, or they're working second or third shift and their kids aren't in school, so they need to be able to have a safe and affordable place for their children. And then the fourth thing we did was we said we've got to increase the income of people getting disability benefits or Social Security if it's too low. So what we did was we developed these policies in great detail, and then we hired the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C., to test whether if you put these policies together, you could make a big impact on poverty. And the Urban Institute came back with some very, very interesting findings. And basically what they found was that if you put in place, through their very sophisticated modeling system, if you imagine that these policies were in place for the whole country, each individual policy would have a modest effect. But if you combined these policies, transitional jobs plus a higher minimum wage, plus a bigger EITC, plus child care, plus higher income for people with disability or Social Security benefits, you could cut the poverty rate by 50%, 60%, maybe 70%. It was dramatic.
And apparently, if people also take advantage of other programs like food stamps and things to the maximum, it would be close to 80% or more than 80%.
That's right. Although I think that, ironically, if people went to work more and earned more, in some cases, the benefits that they would get from food stamps and some of these other programs
would decline,
which is a good reason for welfare costs to decline. It's because you don't need them because people's incomes are high enough. So the conclusion that we reached, Bill, was that there's no reason why we need to have over 40 million poor Americans. There's no reason why we have to have poverty in double digits. This is a man-made or man and woman-made problem. And we can fix it by putting the right policies in place.
This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to David Reamer. We've been discussing his program developed in Milwaukee with a lot of people and tested nationally, and at least tested analytically nationally. I don't think anybody has actually adopted all the provisions that would virtually end poverty. David, some people would say, why do all of that? In Switzerland, at least, an initiative to guarantee a national income narrowly failed. There are a lot of people talking about, in fact, that's really the way of dealing with poverty, especially as manufacturing is moving towards only robots. It's not clear that there are going to be full-time jobs for people. Maybe one of the things we'd want to do is just cut hourly work week to 30 hours. But we really do have to deal with the problem of just not enough work, which, of course, is also the Federal Reserve manages to keep pushing up interest rates, or they did for a long time, to make sure that there was not enough work by slowing the economy, which meant really the federal government was ensuring that 5 or 8 or 10 or 15% of the people went hungry and were destituted. Your program would end poverty. Why not go for, though, the Swiss model and at least fight for that at the same time that you fight for the 5 or 6 programs that you just enumerated?
Well, I do think that providing a guaranteed income makes sense for people who can't work because of a physical or mental disability that's pretty severe. And, of course, I think that for people who reached retirement age as seniors, if for some reason Social Security and other savings are inadequate, that we need to increase their income so they're not poor. Another group I think that we should pay attention to are parents of newborn children or adopted children, perhaps adults caring for a senior who need resources while they're doing something very important for our society, caring for children, caring for someone who's frail or elderly. But on the whole, Bill, I feel pretty strongly that a general guaranteed income for all adults would be a mistake. And here are the reasons why. First of all, if you made it too low, it's not going to be enough. People are going to have to work anyway. If you made it high enough so that it's a decent income, made it $30,000 or $35,000 or $40,000, people will quit their jobs. There'll be a huge disincentive to work. But I think the more fundamental reason has to do with what human beings are. We are programmed as human beings to work. We are commanded to work through various religions. It's in our genes. It's in our culture. Lots of people want to work. Rather than tell people who have this need to work, well, we're not going to help you get work. We'll just give you money. Why not identify useful work to be done and offer that at a decent wage to people? You're correct that because of mechanization and trade and technology and lots of other things, it seems to be the case that for long stretches, the private economy isn't producing enough jobs for people. That's clearly true. But there's a lot of work to be done that's needed and useful above and beyond that which the labor market is willing to pay for.
But you pointed out that people do love to work. People really do want to contribute. That's really in our genes, to cooperate with others and build the society together. Businessmen say if people were guaranteed an income, they would quit my job and live on that money. Well, they might quit his job and live on that money, but they would be doing things. They would look for other things to do which are useful and pleasurable and collaborative with other people. It seems to me that we have to move from an economy where people are forced to work by dint of going hungry at things that are really destructive of them and boring and routine and often the worst jobs, highly authoritarian, not all jobs, not even most, but many, many people only work at them because of that. We shouldn't have jobs like that. I mean, there's some work that's bad and that has to be done, so you'd reward it and make sure, have a draft for it, whatever it would be. But I don't think that the argument that we have to keep wages and benefits low so that people are forced to go into the workforce, that doesn't appeal to me, David. I mean, we're talking about the future and something that should happen, that won't happen tomorrow, but we have to talk about. I think that we'd really want to do these more, quote, utopian proposals, not as substitutes for these more practical things that you could might win, but it still seems to me we have to maintain that vision.
Well, I certainly agree with part of what you've said. I think we should make sure that jobs are available, that jobs pay well, that jobs aren't harmful physically in other ways to the workers. There's a lot of improvement that can be done to make workplaces even safer. At the same time, I think we should be honest about the fact that a lot of the things that we want in life involve a certain amount of repetition. There are in Milwaukee, I suspect there are in Portland, lots of people who would be willing to work in honest, safe, somewhat boring work in exchange for a decent wage, a decent income. I guess what I'd like to do is get to the point where everybody has work if they want it. Everybody has a decent income. Work is safe. Savings are structured so that when you retire, you have enough to live on, combined with Social Security. Continuing the kind of cultural pressure on the quality of work is important. What I don't think is a good idea is just giving everybody somebody else's money.
Which is called a demogrant. Let's call it a demogrant rather than giving people other people's money.
One of the other things that I have a problem with the guaranteed income is frankly just the politics of it. I've spent a lot of time doing door-to-door work, talking to voters in working-class, middle-class parts of the city of Milwaukee, which I suspect aren't too different than working-class, middle-class parts of Portland or any other city. And it's hard for me to imagine making the pitch to someone who I talk to at the doors to agree to the following proposition. You should work hard, maybe not at a job that you like. You should pay taxes. And some of that money should go to people who can work but just don't want to. They just want to get your money.
That's sort of the conservative line. It's a really interesting conversation, though. But there's a couple things, though, that we haven't talked about, which I want to give you a minute to talk about. And one of them is the role of the poor as part of a large coalition that would, in fact, in this very rich country, be able to enact the five or six programs that you discussed earlier in the interview. It seems to me that people free themselves from poverty not just by getting more income and more capacity to earn, but also by getting a much more positive sense of themselves, their capacities, their skills, their worth. And that's the product now of actually doing political stuff and being involved and fighting for yourself and recognizing that you and the people like you are worthy people and deserve the benefits of, in fact, contributing to the society. You get the last word. That's my hypothesis, that, in fact, we really need movements and struggles, and the poor have to be in major positions in those struggles. It can't be just bestowed by a progressive, decent government or group of people. It has to be won, it seems to me, is the way, and that's the only way it could be won.
I totally agree with you, Bill. I think that achieving social and economic justice in this country does require movements, and I think that the people who are poor, unemployed, people who have faced discrimination need to be leaders in that movement. I think I told you earlier that my father, Neil Riemer, who passed away in 2001, was on the March on Washington in 1963, and he was in the throng of people listening to Dr. Martin Luther King speak about his dream. The official title of that march was March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Dr. King understood that the movement that we need for justice in this country is partly a movement about civil rights, but it was partly also a movement about economic rights. And he was involved in bringing not only African Americans, but other low-income people into that movement. One final set of anecdotes I want to mention. Over the years, I've been involved in going to the state legislature to ask for the enactment of programs. We have a small transitional jobs program for unemployed people here in Wisconsin. There's a program that you have in Oregon that performs a similar function. We have a state supplemental earned income tax credit that we were able to persuade the legislature to enact, and you have a similar program recently increased in Oregon, thanks to your state legislature. When we went to the legislators to ask for their enactment of these programs, it wasn't just me and other middle-class people with mastery of spreadsheets and the numbers. We went together with low-income people, and they were typically African-American, and it was their testimony, their stories about their lives and how they wanted to work and how getting a job helped transform them, how they needed enough money from their work to be able to support themselves and their kids. It was their stories and their requests that riveted the attention of policymakers. Had we not been working with them, had they not really in some ways been the lead speakers, we never would have gotten those small incremental measures of economic justice enacted. So this movement has got to involve the poor, the unemployed, minorities, as well as those of us who are in a more fortunate position and maybe have a little bit more technical knowledge. If it's just us making the case, we're not going to succeed. We've got to have a movement.
David Reamer, thanks a lot for talking to us today. It was really good. So long.
Bye-bye.